Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Protest.
What is it this time?
When I ask for self-raising flower, I mean that it should be self-raising. I do not add the words as a frivolity to amuse myself.
And?
You gave me plain flour. So I have a day's baking to throw out unless I am to serve his lordship with a plate full of bricks.
Why didn't you check that it was right?
Now, don't start blaming me. Of course, if I were allowed...
Enough! I will bring the flower.
See that you do.
Well, in case you didn't recognize that, that was the voice of our very beloved Mrs. Patmore from the downstairs kitchen at Downton Abbey. And I thought it would be quite interesting and a lot of fun to talk about the food of the Edwardian era and what goes on at Downton Abbey downstairs, much like the upstairs downstairs that a lot of people would remember from years ago, the Masterpiece Theater. Once again, we have Downton Abbey, and it is just creating waves of fanaticism with people who tape it, watch it over and over again, and can't wait for the next season. And here to join me to talk about the specifics of what might have been going on is culinary historian Kathy Kaufman. Kathy is an independent scholar, a writer, an author, and the chairman of the Culinary Historians of New York. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you so much, Linda.
And I might say we are sitting here having our afternoon tea, getting in the mood.
Absolutely, right? In the mood. Good, strong tea, as it should be in England.
Well, in watching Downton Abbey, and I have to admit, I confess, I am one of those who have been addicted. Just love what goes on downstairs, love the table settings, love all the drama that surrounds it. Much of what happens in this... This series happens in the kitchen, I have to say, or within the purviews of the service staff. And food was always so important, and it seems like they were always eating. As Mrs. Patmore said at one time, she was exhausted because every day was a banquet.
That's what you do at a country house. After all, you don't have the immediate distractions of popping off to the theater as you might in London. And the country house was built on the premise that it would be, in some senses, self-sufficient. You had game and hunting possibilities. You had the garden. You could go foraging for berries and all sorts of wonderful things. And food and the dining room was one of the main focuses of the day. It's not surprising that so much would take place both in the dining room and then all the fabulous little intrigues and conflicts and frustrations and pressures that you feel in the downstairs.
That's
very,
right.
Very difficult.
Indeed. Well, I read somewhere that they said in the food, yes, it was, they were eating all the time, but they said that was the one area where it was precisely the duty to impress with the food they put on the plate.
Absolutely. You had ways of showing your cultural capital, your wealth, done through both who was cooking for you, what they were preparing, and how it was being served, and of course, what the accoutrements were that you had on the table, your silver, your china, your glassware, all of that, particularly with the English. If it could have been handed down for a few generations, you could increase your cultural capital that way.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the service, because mm-hmm. that I really want to talk about that, and I'm sure people want to hear what Carson's instructions were and how he was to serve. You know, so much was not anymore. Was for a while bandied about, but English food. It was so dull. It was so horrible. However, Ivan Day, who is a food historian in England, was interviewed for NPR's food blog, The Salt, and said, well, no, indeed, the food was incredibly good during that period of time. We're
absolutely
talking, what we're talking,
the Edwardian period,
1880 to what,
to
1920.
Well, I guess Edward is off the throne before that, right. But nonetheless, we are talking through certainly the First World War period. You have to keep in mind that at this point, England is a fabulous imperial power. It has a lot of wealth. It can command so many different resources, including French cooks in the kitchen, if you can. And if you can't, a good stout English cook was certainly appreciated. But English food at that time had fabulous butter, fabulous cream, fabulous meats. It had a wonderful, wonderful garden supporting most of the houses, such as Downton Abbey. So there'd be no reason for the food not to be good. English food gets its bad reputation because of all of the true hardships that the population underwent after World War I. Mm-hmm. There was food rationing. Then you have the Great Depression. Then you have World War II and food rationing that lasts well into the 1950s in England. So you really have a, you know, close to half a century of culinary deprivation.
Understandable deprivation from the war on. But
absolutely. So that's really, that is a 20th century phenomenon, not the late 19th through Edwardian period.
Right. Mrs. Patmore is the, as you refer, stout English cook.
Yes.
And yes, had they been of more means, they would have had a French chef, as you mentioned. However, the dishes, many of the dishes that are referred to throughout the show are indeed French dishes.
Absolutely. Bœuf à la mode is one of the favorite dishes that gets imported from France and very, very quickly adopted in England. And you also have to keep in mind that some of the style setters in the late Victorian and then Edwardian period are French chefs who are working in England. You think of Charles Francatelli, who was the chef to Queen Victoria. Mm-hmm. He studied with Antonin Carême and trained in France with Carême. He wrote several cookbooks that were very popular in England, one very elite cookbook for people at Downton Abbey or trying to maintain a very, very fancy lifestyle. And he also wrote cookbooks for lower classes, lower socioeconomic strata, but there would be, to the extent possible, French influences brought into those as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not at all surprising that even with a proper English cook, there would definitely be French influences in the cuisine and, to the extent possible, really emulating the haute cuisine of 19th century France.
Well, in the series, very few dishes are referred to by name, you know, what's really going on the plate, except early on, there was a reference to desserts, crepe Suzette.
Oh, yes.
And a Charlotte.
Yes.
Okay. And I did read where Julian Fellowes, who wrote the series, he called upon Alistair Bruce, a historian, to be the consultant on the show. He's a food historian as well, I believe, and he's also the officer of arms to the Queen. Now, because there is an English woman cook, mm-hmm. not chef, cook in the downstairs
absolutely.
Kitchen, evidently, he based many of the meals, or most of the meals in the series, on Mrs. Beaton's book of household management.
And it's a fabulous book.
Absolutely. And this was published just prior to the period that we're watching in the
series.
Absolutely.
I think it's 1868 is the date for Mrs. Beaton.
And so there we would see more, not necessarily French dishes, but more, but still they would be elite dishes.
They would be very elite dishes, and there are plenty of recipes in Mrs. Beaton that are by their French names, and when you look at the illustrations to Mrs. Beaton, I'm sure the listeners will have seen copies of these illustrations. They may not realize they're from Mrs. Beaton, but they're these wonderful pyramids of, you know, sweets, heavily garnished fish, beautiful roasts, all sorts of food, really arrayed in pyramids, which is what Mrs. Beaton was all about. She mm-hmm. was giving French cuisine for a proper middle-class Victorian household. And, of course, middle class at that point was someone who had a couple of servants. They had a cook. It's not what we think of as middle class. It was a different definition of middle right. class. But it was certainly people who were living in a very stylish, if somewhat sensible, manner. Because, of course, Mrs. Beaton would not want you not to be sensible.
Right.
But the food would have definitely been highly ornamented and ornamental.
Yeah, kind of a 19th century Julia Child, if you will.
I think more of a 19th century Martha Stewart in many ways.
Right.
I think, yes. I think Julia was a little less ornamented than Martha.
Yeah, bringing the French dishes certainly to the classes. Let's talk a little bit about, in fact, the table settings. They're beautiful tables. They don't show, unfortunately. You never get to see a precise close up of
right.
how they've reproduced it. But I'm sure that this Alistair Bruce, did his homework and
yes.
being the in the service of the Queen, he it's de rigueur for him. What would we see on a typical table of this gentry class and of this period in terms of formal setting?
Well, a formal setting would start with the tablecloth, which would have to be a pristine linen or damask cloth. There would be a crease down the middle, which would be the guide to the butler for arraying everything else on that. That center crease was considered very, very important. In England, unlike in the U.S., while you would have some flowers and you would certainly have silver candelabra and your wax candles, it would not be overly profuse. I think there's an interesting juxtaposition between an American table of this time and an English table. And the American table is actually rather gaudy by comparison. Hmm. The English table is a little more refined, a little more discreet. You would certainly have your placeholder plate. You would have several glasses arrayed for the first several courses. A big plate, you would have probably no more than two forks, a soup spoon, and two knives put out at the beginning of the meal. And those would go tines facing up, unlike the French custom of having them tines facing down, which is something that the Americans were never quite sure what they should be doing. So it goes both ways in America at this point. You would then have stacks of dishes ready to go for subsequent courses, additional silverware ready to go. There would be decanters lined up with your wines that would be ready to go. And of course, wine would be matched to the courses, although the matchings may be a bit different than what we're used to today. Mm-hmm. If you look at some of the menus from the 1890s, it's rather horrifying for our modern palates to think sauterne with raw oysters, but that would have been a very, very popular pairing.
Yeah, interesting. Well, the crease down the middle reminds me of one scene where Carson, the head butler, is walking around surveying the table to check to make sure everything is ready and whips out his measuring stick.
Mm-hmm.
He actually takes a ruler and puts it on the table. Now, whether this is hyperbole in what a butler would do, or if he indeed was, was indeed done.
It's completely hyperbole. When you look at a few of the servants' guides in the 19th century, some of them actually do tell you to either measure perhaps a thumb's width or two thumbs' mm-hmm. width. You may not need a ruler, but the idea of lining everything up with the edges was...
It made the point.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I want to talk more about the courses and the many courses when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
following program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery. Kane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.kane5.com.
We are back talking about the food of Downton Abbey with culinary historian Kathy Kaufman. And Kathy, you had mentioned before the break all the dishes, all the plates that would be ready for the many courses. Let's talk about how many courses. Let's say in not your stand. Well, it actually would be the standard Wednesday night dinner. But let's talk about a little bit more of a show, an elegant Saturday night when you had a few guests up from the city.
A few guests from the city, perhaps the local pastor over and all of that, yes.
And an eligible young bachelor, yes.
Oh, we always need eligible young bachelors, don't we? The number of courses could vary, but at absolute minimum, you would assume there would be about six courses, starting most typically with oysters, or if it's not an R month, raw clams. You have to keep in mind that the prohibition against oysters in months without an R was very, very firmly adhered to.
And refrigeration was not.
It was not all over. You would not have the same ease and convenience, but you would have ice houses. It mm-hmm. wouldn't actually be that hard, and the transportation from coastal areas in England into the countryside would make oysters a relatively easy product to handle, surprisingly so. After that, you would have a soup, or actually, if you were doing an elegant meal, you would probably have two soups, a choice between a clear consommé and then a cream, or sometimes what they call a thick soup. Mm-hmm. It could be some sort of pureed vegetable potage, something like that.
Now, we were talking prior to the show about the china and how it was much different than what we would imagine today, although some people still have collections of it. It's around. You see it in many restaurants as well. The soup would be served in a soup bowl, but more like a coffee cup or a teacup.
Well, a bouillon cup with the two little handles on either side that you feel you could almost pick them up and sip from them, but of course you would never do that. That would be horrifying. But there were very, very specific rules for eating your soup. One is that you would scoop the soup with your soup spoon and only sip from the edge of the soup, never from the end. It was considered extremely poor form to tip your soup bowl to get the last bit, so you always left this little film of, you know, culinary delight that if you're very hungry, you've been out riding all afternoon and having such a strenuous day, and it's, you know, your second course, you can hardly wait for the next courses to come in. But there was a strict etiquette, and you didn't eat much soup. You were served a half a ladleful of soup at an elegant meal. If it was a, quote, casual meal, you were entitled to a full ladleful, but even so, compared to what we think of as modern portions, you're eating much less per course, which of course allows you to have 6 or 10 or 12 or 18 different courses.
And then after the soup, we would have?
You would have what was called the hors d'oeuvre. And the hors d'oeuvre would be not the little canapé that we think of at a cocktail party, but it could be something en croûte, perhaps a pastry shell with a little bit of creamed chicken. It could be something as simple as some sardines. It would really vary, and you could have actually a choice of several different hors d'oeuvre. It would not necessarily be one choice. And in an elegant meal, of course, you would have a menu that had either been printed more often in London and in the countryside, handwritten by the lady of the house, that would be placed at each setting. And then the diner would be able to look and decide what it is they would eat, because, of course, the courses would be served by a waiter to the left, and the diner would help themselves from the platter. So you might not particularly like something, but if you saw that none of the hors d'oeuvres were your favorites, you would probably make the best of a bad choice and pick the one that was most appealing to you?
Now, that's an interesting point, because there was a scene in one of the episodes which mm-hmm. illustrates this very nicely. And the butler comes around, or the head servant comes around with a very large tray up to somebody who's new at the house, the young man who comes from not quite as elegant surroundings. Mm-hmm. And he approaches him from the left with the big tray. And the young man, of course, being a little bit bowled over by all this finery, just sort of sits there. And then, of course, the daughter explains to him and instructs him, well, you are to serve, a diner serves himself from the tray.
Right? Yes, that is the classic Russian service technique. That is something that if we were asked to do that today, we would be rather awkward. But you had been in training to do this all your life. If you grew up in a proper household and you would know exactly how to do it, you would not sit and look at it or even think about what it is you wanted. Some of the examples, and this often happens with the roast course, you should decide and know your preferences right in advance and not decide, do I want the wing or the breast or the leg?
And never take the utensils, lift a piece, and put it back.
No. You will never be invited back again if you do that.
One shot and one shot only.
Absolutely. No, you must show proper demeanor, but you should know your mind. As some of the etiquette books say, and I think it's such a wonderful way of looking at life, you really do need to know your mind on such trifles as dinner.
Exactly. We have so much to think about. So we made it through the appetizer, course, right?
You will then have a fish course, and that could be trout, salmon, sole, you know, so many, many different things.
Now, remember, at least three wines have been served to point. I mean, there is a different wine. I'm granted a few sips, but a different wine. They're always sipping and always eating, right?
Well, and it's interesting when you look at the wine glasses from that time, they tend to be a bit smaller than our modern wine glasses. So you don't, I mean, when you think about these modern balloon glasses that we all love because they're so sensual and you can have so much wine in them, well, you would never see anything like that at this period. And while people would never fill their glass all the way up, you could have the glass refilled several times and still have a relatively modest amount of wine. Drunkenness was certainly not anything that was encouraged at the table.
Well, I liked hearing too that something that has continued up to present day, that it just a slight touch of the hand to the rim of the glass indicates to whoever's serving that no more, you've had enough.
Well, there's a real controversy about that. Some people think that is vulgar at this point in time, that you just look at the waiter and you say, thank you. And that is the signal you don't want wine. When they come along with the wine, you can either nod or just let them pour. But to stop them, you say thank you. You don't even raise your hand.
And I thought it was still always the touch of the rim. That's interesting. I love that.
It depends. Yeah. There is no agreement 100% on etiquette. You can find different writers who will say different things. So it depends upon your author whether that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. So we have a fish course coming. How many courses have we had so far?
I guess this is roughly four courses at this point. Then you're certainly going to need a roast course.
And no red wine will have been served, generally speaking. I mean, I know there are exceptions to the rule, but you won't have a red wine until after the fish.
You will not have a red wine until after the fish. And even with the roast, some people preferred whites or some preferred champagne. I mean, some people had champagne.
Why not?
Well, yes, if you can, why not? But they would have champagne throughout the meal. But yes, the roast would be the first course where you would have your red wine, and that would often be a Burgundy or a Bordeaux. That is, the English, they like their claret. Of course, they would never say Bordeaux. They would say claret, which should be accurate and British.
Now, most likely we have not seen anything green on the table yet. No vegetables yet.
Not completely true. With the fish course, depending upon the type of fish, you might have boiled potatoes and cucumber salad. to go with it, and mm-hmm. those would go together. And certainly with the roast course, there would be vegetable garnishes
On the roast course, definitely,
Come along. So you're starting to get them at this point. It is, of course, possible that even in some of your hors d'oeuvre courses, if you've got one of these little puff pastry things filled with a little cream chicken, there would be peas in it or asparagus. And depending on the season, your soup might also be a vegetable-based soup. So while you won't see vegetables in the sense of, you know...
A meat and two.
Yeah, exactly. It's not center of the plate and two.
Right.
They are being worked into the menu with relative frequency, but not as... fundamental as we tend to think mm-hmm. of them.
So that was a roast course, kind of winding down your third course.
Well,
was that
exactly.
It?
No, Linda, no, there's more to come. And we've actually even gotten rid of the relevé course, which could come between the fish and the roast, but not necessarily. And that could be just any old meat course that was not considered a roast. It mm-hmm. might be a braised dish or a boiled dish. But yes, you do have to get to the roast. At some point, you then need to move to Roman punch, which is something that I really wish would come back. Roman punch is a flavored, slushy wine, and it's a palate cleanser, and it's just absolutely delightful and something that really should come back in style. I think that's one of the few things that I would say must come back from the Edwardian times.
And did they, and what was the French, did the French then, where did we get the sorbets in between? Was that from... Which came first, the slushy wine or the sorbets as the palate cleansers? I mean, that was...
I think the slushy wines were probably there first, simply because you see them on so many menus in the Victorian era, and you don't really see sorbet listed on them. Now, of course, I'm talking about Anglo-American menus, and I think if you were in France, you might see something a little bit different. But I think we then borrowed the French technique many years later on.
Well, we're moving along here in our menu, so there could be, if it were really fancy, we'd have a few more of these courses.
Oh, of course.
Repetitious.
Oh, we have a game course.
But then we have to move on to the dessert, or desserts, plural.
Yes, the desserts, plural, because there are probably at least three different dessert courses. There's what's called a hot entremets, which is probably a soufflé or something like that. Then there is the cold entremets, which would be, say, a Bavarian cream, something like that. And then there's dessert proper, which would be candied fruits, fresh fruits, cakes, pies, jams, confiture, that sort of thing. But those would be done in three separate courses.
Mm. And, of course, then there's coffee and brandy.
Brandy. Of course, the brandy is for the men.
For the men. I was saying,
of course.
Not for the women.
No.
We'd have to get up and leave.
Yes. No, the coffee would be served, but the women would then retire to the drawing room to do whatever the women did in the drawing room, while the men would have brandy and cigars.
Cigars, yes.
But in England, they wouldn't stay there too long. Either the wine or the brandy would be passed around the table a couple of times, but the men then joined the ladies for the after-dinner entertainments. A little live music by the family or guests, and then the evening would draw to a very happy conclusion.
Poor Mrs. Patmore. She really had her work cut out.
She had to work very hard. And the problem was it started all again the next day. But don't forget there was a breakfast with meats and eggs and porridge and all of that to be gotten up.
And the pastries and the crusts. And usually she had, as far as kitchen aides, she wouldn't have, it, depending on the wealth of the family, but let's say just the moderate gentry, upper class, she wouldn't have more than one or two assistants, most likely.
That's probably right.
Yeah.
It was a tremendous amount of work, and the reason why downstairs was such a different place from upstairs.
That's right. This is so much fun, and I think we should have a banquet, a Downton Abbey banquet. We have to hire Mrs. Patmore in. She has got to cook for us. But thanks. I hope that you've shed some light for a lot of our listeners who are enjoying the series and who will then take a little more interest when they do see the kitchen scenes come up and realize what a lot of labor it all was.
Very labor-intensive. This is pre-electricity.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. Well, thank you so much for listening. Again, this has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Pelagio. Thanks to Kathy Kaufman.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.